Good evening, it's Sunday, June 20th, 2021. Coming up, as both Juneteenth and Father's Day are celebrated this weekend, advocates say it's important to remember that not all fathers have their freedom.
It's a combination of Father's Day, Juneteenth, and Freedom Day at the same time. So to those of us that suffer from white supremacy and the system that's totally against us as Black men, it's a double whammy against us.
While Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday is a milestone in history, how do we make sure that the lives of people across the gender spectrum are also remembered and honored?
So it's particularly important to me that those of us who are not cis men are also seen as worthy of protecting and worthy of fighting for.
With record-breaking heat across California and much of the United States this week, some say it's time to do more than recycle and drive less.
Methane is 25 times worse for the climate than carbon dioxide and accounts for 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions from livestock.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. On Thursday, President Biden signed legislation making Juneteenth, or June 19th, a federal holiday commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. The roots of the day are in Galveston, Texas, on June 19th, 1865. That's when Major General Gordon Granger announced the Emancipation Proclamation, stating that all people who had been enslaved were then free. Just hours before June 19th, with 93-year-old lifetime activist Opal Lee by his side, President Biden declared June 19th a federal holiday.
This is a day of profound, in my view, profound weight and profound power. A day in which we remember the moral stain, the terrible toll that slavery took on the country and continues to take. What I've long called America's original sin. At the same time, I also remember the extraordinary capacity to heal and to hope and to emerge.
Vice President Kamala Harris also signed the legislation in her capacity as Senate President.
National holidays are something important. These are days when we as a nation have decided to stop and take stock, and often to acknowledge our history.
Well, this is an important milestone in history. Having Juneteenth commemorated the same weekend as Father's Day is bringing to light a particular irony. While Black men make up just over 6% of the general population in the United States, they account for well over 50% of the incarcerated population. I spoke to Pastor Kenneth Sharpton Glasgow, the founder of the Ordinary People Society, about what this means for Black children and fathers in the United States today.
It's Juneteenth, Freedom Day, but my brothers and sisters are still locked up. And as Fannie Lou Hamer said, ain't nobody free until everybody's free.
Glasgow, who struggled with an addiction, was incarcerated for nearly a decade and a half when convicted for related crimes, was away from his own children for many years.
It was very, very wearing on me because I realized I had a young Black son and a young daughter growing up and being subject to a system that had gotten me because of my drug use and many, many others that was in there. Some of them shouldn't have never been there at all. And that system still plays out.
How would your life have been different if you had access to a rehabilitation program?
If I had went to like the Haven I went to these last time I was locked up for those 60 days, if I had went somewhere like that to get really in touch with me and my feelings and myself, I would have been a very, very different person. My family would have been different. Those 14 years I missed in their life would have been different. The dynamics of our family relationships would have been totally different. We all would not have the scars and the trauma of me being in prison and being incarcerated. My mother wouldn't have it at 75 years old. And it would have took away the paranoia that exists and the trauma that exists even now after that. Because a lot of people don't understand the after effects are just as bad as the in effects.
It was while he was on solitary confinement in the 90s that Glasgow was inspired not only to turn his own life around, but to help other people behind bars access everything from voting rights to meals to transitional services, which led him to found the Ordinary People Society. Glasgow never takes Father's Day for granted. but is still struggling to reconcile how to support so many families who aren't able to celebrate it together.
You want to celebrate this Father's Day and being with your children, but at the same time, I'm thinking about all the fathers that are not there with their children. At the same time, I'm thinking about what can I do with the for those fathers that are not with their children, and what can I do for their children who are not with their fathers? So I want to ask them, and I'm going to ask them after this interview, I'm going to get online and ask them, is there any way I could like buy a gift for your child for, and say this comes from your father? Like I do every Christmas. And kid, is there a way that I can get with the children to say, hey, let's make cards to send to your father? So he know that even though you're not there with him, you're still with him. And then to think about is Freedom Day and Juneteenth. And for the first time in history, it just became a national holiday. But we're still up under these same draconian laws that took away our freedom in the first place. So I get emotional, Sharon, because I'm trying to figure out how the hell do I feel?
I caught up with Glasgow's daughter, Kenyatta, while she was driving in a Juneteenth caravan in Birmingham, Alabama.
We're celebrating the memorial of a federal holiday from our ancestors, but we can't really celebrate it for us, because we're still going.
Kenyatta recalled what it was like to grow up without her dad.
I've always been a daddy's girl. I remember him leaving to go to prison when I was 7. And he came back when I was 16. So it was kind of hard because I ended up having to go stay with Linda for like 4 years.
Linda is the name of Kenyatta's biological mother.
But those were the worst 4 years of my life. And I recall, like, my daddy would send me birthday cards and letters and stuff when he was incarcerated. And she just was not with it. She would rip them up.
Kenyatta says that while she missed her dad, the two of them began rebuilding the relationship and joined forces in advocacy work as soon as he was released.
I remember him coming home right after I had my first daughter. And he kept asking me, he was like, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? And I told him, just be a daddy. And ever since then, when he came home, he changed his life and he got into advocacy work. And I remember back in 2008, when he got a lawsuit passed for people that have not been convicted of a crime under moral turpitude, they can get registered to vote. I remember going out with him, registering people to vote. It was a fun experience because I told him, drop me off in the community housing. And by the time I finished, I had registered over like 500 people that day. And, you know, like with seeing his reaction to being excited to be able to teach me the things that he has learned and to be able to conquer them and achieve them, it really, you know, brought us to a different level. You know, like when he was gone, I wasn't upset or angry with him. I was hurt because I wanted my daddy. But when he got out and he came home, he was totally different. And I just thank God that I was able to rebuild our relationship.
Now, at the age of 37, Kenyatta is back in college, on track to become a drug and alcohol counselor.
It's not our fault that our parents had an addiction. It's not. I want to open up a free drug clinic. Because, you know, with the work, my dad, you know, we have a soup kitchen. It's so many people that you meet on a daily basis that just need someone to give them some assistance. The drug treatment centers, you know, they're expensive. People can't afford that. So I want to bring something different to Dothan.
That was Pastor Kenneth Sharpton Glasgow and his daughter, Kenyatta Glasgow, from the Ordinary People Society. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. A year ago, people across the world took to the streets after watching footage of George Floyd dying under the knee of Derek Chauvin. On April 20th of this year, right around the time that Chauvin's guilty verdict was announced, a 16-year-old girl named Micaiah Bryant was fatally shot by a police officer in Ohio. Bryant's story quickly faded into the background. I spoke to activist and performing arts professor Amissa Miller about why some stories fall through the cracks and how we can shift the narrative.
Quite a lot of the work that I do lives in the realm of what we might call interactive theater or applied theater, but at the core of it is the inspiration of a Brazilian artist and activist and theorist named Augusto Boal, who pioneered a method of art making called theater of the oppressed. His standpoint is that all of us are artists and all of us are actors, and that theater is actually a tool to, as he said, rehearse the revolution. A lot of the work that I do is really rooted in the belief that theater is not just an experience where we sort of sit back and passively take in a story, that theater is actually something that we are actively participating in as we are building the world that we want to live in.
If we look at the world as our stage and we look at all the different incidents of racial injustice that are happening, particularly you and I were talking about how even within the different social justice movements, there's a gendered component there. And sometimes some of the women whose lives have been lost to police violence, I've heard we're not talking about them as much. And what is coming up for you as I'm talking about this?
It is powerful that as many people as we saw last summer took to the streets because of the, I think, particular nature of the brutality of George Floyd's murder and the fact that it was documented in a way that it was impossible to ignore. But it's also disheartening that we have not seen that same mass mobilization on behalf of Black girls, Black women, Black gender nonconforming people. I'm thinking in particular, of course, of Micaiah Bryant. As we all were waiting and watching to see what the verdict would be in the Derek Chauvin trial, 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant called the police for help, felt unsafe, felt threatened, was trying to defend herself, and ended up losing her life. And rather than seeing people rallying to support, I've seen a lot of folks looking for reasons to blame her for her death, rather than blaming the officer who shot her, rather than blaming the system of policing itself, rather than blaming the society that criminalizes Black youth. If we are ever to achieve the liberation that we say that we want as Black communities, we have to recognize that that means all of us. And too often we see that Black women and girls are right there at the forefront of our liberation movements, doing the organizing work, leading the protests, doing the mutual aid work, you know, speaking the names of Black people of all genders. So often Black women and girls are right there. And far too often we see that when we are the ones who've been killed, when we are the ones who've been harmed, whether that's harm that's coming externally from outside of our community or harm that is happening within our community, we don't see that same mobilization to show up for us. And I believe that that is the next frontier in our Black liberation movement. If we can get to a place intracommunally where we slay the dragons of misogynoir, we slay the dragons of cis-heteropatriarchy, if we can slay those dragons, this is what Barbara Smith and the folks in the Combahee River Collective were saying, that when we make sure that Black women and girls and gender nonconforming folks are safe and well, it necessarily means that all of us are.
While Micaiah Bryant's name may have slipped out of the news headlines, Miller says it's important to keep her story alive.
I've actually seen quite a few of Micaiah's TikTok videos. One of the things that I've appreciated is just getting to see her as a 16-year-old making TikToks where she's doing different hairstyles and, you know, smiling and preening for the camera and, you know, brushing down her baby hairs while listening to music, and her softness, her joy, her being a child. I've really appreciated that because far too often, especially when we lose our young people, we tend to forget that they're not martyrs. They're not poster children. They're actually just our babies. They're our young people. As much as it is important for us to remember how she died, it's really important for me to remember how she lived.
In response to those who suggested that because Micaiah had a knife, her killing was justified, Miller says that logic simply falls short and perpetuates a dangerous type of blaming the victim mentality.
On some level, we want to believe that if we make the right choices, then we will not end up becoming hashtags. And so some part of us subconsciously is looking at her and saying, what are the things that she did wrong? What are the things that her family did wrong? And if I can avoid doing those things, and if I can tell my children to avoid doing those things, then maybe we will be safe. But of course, we know that that's not true. We know that Ayana was asleep in her bed and she was 7 years old. Brianna was asleep in her bed. Tatiana was playing video games with her nephew. None of these are criminal acts. There are no weapons involved. And yet all three of those people are dead. We have to be the ones to say that we are ready to fight for our liberation. And that has to mean that we have to believe that every Black life is precious.
And this is speculative, but using informed theater as your lens in a way that we could have approached Micaiah's calling the police different, what would be an alternative for those people who can't imagine how this could have gone any other way?
It's interesting that you use the word speculative because, you know, in a lot of ways, I think this fight for liberation is speculative work. We are attempting to envision and then hopefully enact a world that we have never known. We've never known this world without anti-Blackness, without misogynoir. We've never known this world without policing, without prisons. And so it is speculative work. It really is saying, you know, can we use a radical imagination to envision a different world and a different way of being? And then can we take the steps toward creating that? Folks within our communities every day are doing this work of supporting our young people, of mentoring our young people, of intervening in conflict. The disconnect is that that police officer didn't look at Micaiah and think, how do I de-escalate in a way that actually preserves life? So my response to that is, if we want to think about what could have happened differently in that situation, look to folks who are doing that work with young people in our communities. Look to folks who are doing violence interruption work. Look to folks who are doing restorative justice work. Look to folks who are every day loving and engaging with and supporting and protecting and preserving the lives of young Black people, of young Black girls and boys and gender nonconforming people, because they're already practicing that.
Regarding Derek Chauvin's guilty verdict, Miller says that we must not mistake punishment with accountability.
For me, accountability actually means that there has to be some kind of a relationship, right? I am accountable to you because I have a relationship with you. There's mutual investment there. And it's abundantly clear that police are not accountable to Black people. I certainly don't want to minimize the fact that for families of folks who've been murdered by the state, for many of them, it does matter that the folks who have murdered their loved ones face some sort of consequence. But I think it's important to make that distinction that just because an individual faces consequences for an action that they've taken doesn't necessarily mean that accountability is happening.
That's Professor and activist Amissa Miller. Much of California and a large section of the country experienced a heat wave with record-breaking temperatures last week. This has some climate activists and animal rights activists calling on Americans to do more to reduce our carbon footprint. Monica Chen is the executive director of the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. She says what we eat and mass produce for consumption is just as important as what we drive when we're thinking about our carbon footprints.
According to our most recent data sourced from Climate Watch, transportation emits about 16% of the world's greenhouse gases. And if you add up the emission from livestock and manure, soil, crop burning, deforestation, and energy and agriculture and fishing, much of which is connected to factory farming, you end up at about 15.4%. So the impact from factory farming in terms of climate change is significant.
If you're going to just drive your Prius, it's not enough, is what you're saying.
I celebrate all things that people can be doing to reduce their carbon footprint in some way. It's just a shame that many of the local city climate action plans will focus so much on transportation, but not include food. But we do recognize that animals, especially cows, directly emit greenhouse gases. They burn methane and their feces release nitrous oxide. Methane is 25 times worse for the climate than carbon dioxide and accounts for 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions from livestock. And nitrous oxide, which accounts for 24% of greenhouse gas emissions from livestock, is up to 300 times worse for climate change than carbon dioxide. So what's coming out of cows is up to 300 times worse than what's coming out of our cars. And then when you combine that with the fossil fuels required to grow the corn and soy and factor in all the deforestation, and then meets huge carbon footprint, starts to make a lot more sense.
June is National Dairy Month, or a time that people in states like Wisconsin have traditionally been encouraged to consume more dairy products. Chen says it's important to note that in spite of the slogans, cow's milk doesn't necessarily do all bodies good, and that the cows producing it may be less happy than the commercials make them out to be.
You know, it's no accident that cow's milk is in all of our schools, and it is usually the option available to our students, even though, you know, 90% of Asians, 75% of Africans are lactose intolerant or struggle to digest lactose, but that is what the standard is because the government has supported that. One of my favorite questions to ask audience members is, where does cow's milk come from? And for a lot of people, it's the grocery store, right? They don't like fully understand that these cows are not magical milk machines, that they have to have a baby, a calf, in order to produce that milk. And they are artificially inseminated to make that happen. And these cows are hooked up to machine 3 times a day that to take away the milk that's intended for the calf. And then after 10 to 12 months of being milked, they are again artificially impregnated so that they produce more milk. Their calf is then taken away from her and she's again milked 3 times a day. And this happens to her year after year until she can no longer produce a valuable amount of milk. And then she is turned into hamburger meat or dog food. And it's a tough existence.
Chen says that plant-based foods are the fastest growing segment of the grocery store industry, which is inspiring some farmers to reimagine their work.
Those foods are seeing a huge rise in demand. If you go to the Navajo Reservation, the local Walmart, you will find plant-based milks there, the almond milks, the oat milks, and that's incredible. And for people to be purchasing these alternatives, of course, the chains have noticed and they're starting to make that available in other stores as well. We're also seeing that it can be profitable for farms that historically were farming cows for dairy to make a switch. I think a really great example is Elmhurst. They were a dairy farm and now they've switched to plant-based milks completely and found that that's actually more profitable for their family farm.
Well, it might not be realistic for everyone to take up vegetarianism. Chen says a good place to start might be implementing Green Mondays as a day to consume primarily plant-based foods. The democracy of the internet has led to unprecedented freedom of communication, making it possible for people from the most distant parts of the world to communicate in seconds via email, blogs, and social media. Its shadow side is the threat of Big Brother censoring, surveilling, and controlling communications with algorithms. KPFA's Ann Garrison reports on the development of Panquake, a social media platform intended to avoid all these pitfalls.
This week, software development manager Susie Dawson paused work on Panquake to explain the new social media platform to reporters who signed a non-disclosure agreement regarding its details. She also explained Panquake basics to comedian Lee Camp on his YouTube show, Moment of Clarity.
So Panquake is a next generation short messaging service. It's similar to Twitter in that you get to send short messages to a timeline, but it has a bunch of new functionality that just blow Twitter out of the water in terms of your ability to gain greater social reach, but also to have faith in the content that you see, to know that it's what you actually want to see. It's blockchain technology, so every interaction and every public post is indelibly recorded onto the web in a way that you can prove it hasn't been manipulated or censored or messed with. We have no shadow banning. We have no horrible moderation algorithms. It's totally opt-in in terms of content. If you haven't chosen to see content, you're not going to see it. Like, I logged into Twitter today and literally my entire timeline was stuff from accounts that I don't follow and that hadn't been shared by someone I do follow. My entire timeline, top to bottom.
Panquake developers are working on a shoestring budget crowdfunded by individuals, not corporations or foundations. Once the social media platform has launched, it plans to sustain itself on subscriptions of $5 per month or more, though it will provide hardship subscriptions for those to whom $5 per month would be burdensome. Panquake does not ask for the name, phone number, email address, or any other identifying information of subscribers, so there will be no way it could sell users' data even if it wanted to. And no one who chooses to pay more than the $5 per month subscription rate can buy undue influence over the network, as the owners of corporate and state corporate media do. The network will not sell advertising or increased visibility for particular posts. Here's Susie Dawson.
I didn't expect that we would ever get this far this quickly. It's only been, what, nearly five months since we launched the idea, the concept of Panquake. And in this really short time, we have come very, very far, both in the development of the front end and the back end. And that is because we've had incredible support from the public throughout. So we needed to raise $50,000 as a benchmark just to establish the business, because we needed to set up in zones outside of the US where we would be somewhat protected from US lawfare, et cetera. That was expensive, but we raised that money inside of 3 weeks. We thought it was going to take 2 months. We raised it in 3 weeks. And then since then, we're up to $127,000 of our $167,000 target for our build of our beta product. Compared to a commercial build, this would be a multi-million dollar build for any company in the world that even attempted to build something on the scale of what we're doing. And it would take several years. And we are working twice as fast as I've seen any of my commercial projects move. And that's because the people involved in the project are so dedicated and so determined to get this out to the public.
Some liberals, Democrats, and even leftists applauded when Twitter banned Donald Trump, making it impossible for him to reach his 89 million Twitter followers. But others warned that by doing that, Twitter set a precedent for banning anyone outside a rapidly narrowing span of permissible discourse on the platform, and perhaps even cutting people off from the networks that they have now spent years building. Panquake is meant to make sure that subscribers are able to sustain and build those networks. Again, here's Susie Dawson.
We've just seen all of our friends and all the best content creators consistently being suppressed and silenced and shadow banned and censored by big tech platforms. And we knew, like, the time is right for us to create a solution before it's too late and we're completely silenced and, you know, lose these relationships that we've forged over so many years. And Panquake is how we're doing that.
For more information on Panquake, see panquake.com. That's PANQUAKE.com. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the upper 50s, mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the 70s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, clear tonight with lows in the 70s, sunny tomorrow with highs topping 100 and a heat advisory in place. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's newscast. Thanks to EA, who's at the controls. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. And lastly, I want to wish all the fathers who are out there listening a happy Father's Day. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.